This episode was originally broadcast in 2013.
Major funding for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation. From Virginia Humanities, this is Backstory.
I have the pleasure to present to you Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
You'd be hard-pressed today to find someone who doesn't recognize the phrase, "I have a dream." But it's worth noting that those four words, "I have a dream," didn't come until the very end of King's speech that day. David Blight is a historian at Yale University, and he says the first 14 minutes of the speech were all about the past, not the future. And he says it's important to remember that the very same time that King gave his speech, the nation was marking the centennial of the Civil War.
50 years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation.
Of course, he starts with 50 because he's drawing off the famous 40 of the Gettysburg Address. He's reminding the country that this was 1963, the 100th anniversary year of the Emancipation Proclamation, and that, as he says, four times as a refrain in the first paragraph of the dream speech, "And the Negro is not free, and the Negro is not free.
The Negro still is not free." 100 years later,
he's there asking the United States to live up to its creeds. And, of course, those creeds are stated in the Declaration of Independence, which he draws on. And then it's restated, reinvented, in a way, in the Emancipation Proclamation and the constitutional amendments that came out of the Civil War.
"When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note."
In the second paragraph, he draws on what he called the promissory note, which had come back, he says, labeled insufficient funds in the Bank of American Justice. That's an unforgettable, powerful metaphor.
"It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned."
Did people think about the civil rights struggle and think about the centennial of the Civil War at the same time? I mean, we look back on it, and of course, you know, those two things happening exactly 100 years apart, the irony strikes us now. What did people at the time think about that?
The truth is, the huge public commemoration that we know as the Civil War Centennial, which had a national commission with large budgets, there were state commissions in virtually every state, especially southern states, there were lots of reenactments, there were all kinds of commemorations of the blue and the gray, and the glory enough to be spread around in the kind of national reconciliation of the Civil War. But that Civil War centennial, in all of its popular cultural manifestations, and the civil rights movement, this growing, huge civil disobedience movement in the streets of the United States, in which people were risking their lives and dying, the two never actually occupied the same space very often. It's what makes that moment at the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, the March on Washington, and that particular speech so poignant, because King brought the two together. And he's saying to the country, to the world, you know, look, we're having this huge celebration, was the word often used, of a civil war, a vast civil war in which hundreds of thousands of people had died, the country all but destroyed and then preserved and reinvented, slavery ended, followed by a regime of segregation that still existed. The two stories were so intimately tied, but not in the popular imagination.
"We have also come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now." This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism.
King is not just challenging Southern segregationists in this moment. I mean, he is, but that's not all he's challenging. He's challenging the whole nation. He's challenging the whole idea of a grand national narrative of who we are. He's saying we're having this anniversary of the Civil War, but we're forgetting what it was about. And that's why we're here today. That's why we're here. We're marching on the government because the promises that that Civil War brought about are utterly unfulfilled.
So even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream.
Why, in our own memory, have we edited out the great majority of the I Have a Dream speech for just that last part? Why have we edited out the Civil War and the Emancipation Proclamation in our memory?
Well, terrific question. I suppose it's because it's much easier to teach young children the last 3 minutes of that speech. That's about a dream of racial cooperation. It's about a dream of integration. It's about a dream of brotherhood and sisterhood. I remember there's a wonderful passage by James Baldwin, who was, of course, at the march. And afterward, he wrote, among other things, about it. He said, it was a day when we could see our heritage. We could see our inheritance. It was like you could see your history. You could feel your history. But I don't think you were feeling the history just from the last 3 minutes about the dream. You were feeling it as King took you through that litany of its denial.
And that's part of your answer, isn't it? People don't want to hear about denial and betrayal, right?
No, we don't. We like the end, not the story of how we got there. I find myself sometimes when, you know, every year on King's birthday and then throughout the year, we sometimes endlessly hear about keeping the dream alive, keeping the dream alive. Well, of course we all want to keep the dream alive, but sometimes I think that very language gets in the way of what we're actually talking about.
I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state...
David Blight is a professor of history at Yale.
That'll do it for us today. Thanks for joining me to take a look back at the Backstory Archive. There are hundreds of other shows available at our website, backstoryradio.org. You can keep the conversation going online. Let us know what you thought of an episode or ask us your question about history. Send us an email at backstory@virginia.edu. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, @BackstoryRadio. Backstory is produced at Virginia Humanities. Major support is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, the Johns Hopkins University, and the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations. Additional support is provided by the Tomato Fund, cultivating fresh ideas in the arts, the humanities, and the environment.
Brian Ballow is Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Ed Ayers is Professor of the Humanities and President Emeritus of the University of Richmond. Joanne Freeman is Professor of History and American Studies at Yale University. Nathan Connolly is the Herbert Baxter Adams Associate Professor of History at the Johns Hopkins University. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for Virginia Humanities.